This is Digital Music Trends, episode 127, recorded on the 10th of April 2013. This week on the show, video is in, BBM Music is out, lovely infographics from the BPI and Pandora, Gema's new fees for DJs, and much more. Hello everyone, and welcome to Digital Music Trends, the weekly show covering the latest news in the music tech industry. DMT is available as audio and video on iTunes, most podcatchers, SoundCloud, YouTube, Stitcher, Mixcloud, and TuneIn Radio. So this week on the show, I'm really happy to welcome Tom Davenport, freelance journalist writing for a variety of publications. So hi Tom, and great to have you on. How's it going?
Very well. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for being on, and it's just us two today because unfortunately I had Virginie Berger scheduled on the show, but she had internet connectivity issues, so she couldn't make the Skype call. But it's actually quite a busy week, so I think between the two of us we should be able to cover all the topics. And so let's start by talking about video, which is not a digital music service at all, but it's very much part of the picture. So after years of rumors, the service is finally gone live in the US and UK. Okay, just for RDO Premium subscribers. And just a couple of weeks after we mentioned the Spotify rumor in connection to Spotify possibly being in the process of working on a video service. So it's interesting that the video service is now finally online, but surprisingly it doesn't follow RDO's footsteps in terms of model, because it's a pay-per-view service. And of course, you know, we were discussing a couple of weeks back how it was difficult for RDO, of course, to and for Spotify probably it's going to be difficult if they're working on a video service to create a catalog large enough to offer a decent subscription service. And so pay-per-view seems like a good way to go. But, you know, first of all, Tom, what are your thoughts on launching a service of this kind that is different from what users may have expected from a service like RDO, for example?
Well, I think it's a... You make a good point about them not having enough of a catalogue to have a subscription service, because people are going to expect, you know, a lot of content. It's something that's taken Netflix years to pick up on.
Yeah, sure. I think
on that same point, there's actually the other reasons for adoption, because it's going to be hard for people who are new customers to video. I just realized it's hard to pronounce that without being clear
exactly,
what's VVO, whatever you want to call it.
So, yeah, that's true.
But you know, any new entrant to the video streaming space is going to be, you know, it would be ballsy to ask for a subscription.
Yeah.
Because not just because of the catalog, because, you know, you're going to be a new name. Yeah. And you need to convince people to sign up to that. And there's so many subscription services popping up out of the woodwork the last couple of years that, you know, people want to have a sense that they're going to the best one.
Yeah.
Or you know, they don't want to, you know, have to go to different places. You know, it'd be nice to have just the right one.
Yeah.
It's not necessarily clear what the right one is at the minute.
And of course, you know, Netflix got slaughtered when it launched in the UK because it didn't have enough catalog. And even then it had, you know, a decent catalog, but of course it wasn't enough for most users. So so the bar is set pretty high at this point in when you launch a new service, at least in the UK and the US. Mm. But the price points, of course, are a little bit high. RDO is offering video is offering $25 or £20, I think, of free credit to the RDO premium consumers. And I guess, like, I'm interested in what the play is on their part. Like, on the one side, you would think that there's so many outlets offering video online at the moment. But I guess the challenge for services like RDO, Spotify, Deezer is to really reduce the churn in users and reduce users from leaving that ecosystem. So I guess there's some value there in keeping the users engaged in that particular ecosystem and not letting them out into other services, of course. But I don't know, is that enough of a value to create a whole company around? Do you think there's money to be made in that?
There's absolutely money to be made in, I assume you mean streaming, you know, content. People are, you know, people go through content like food right now. I mean, you know, people are taken to streaming better than a lot of people expected. A few years ago, it was a bit of a, you know, are people going to be okay with this? Of course, the technology and bandwidth supports it, so it's kind of working. But when you say it's about keeping people in the ecosystem, I think it's one thing audio and video, again, it's kind of, that's a little hard because they don't have a sort of umbrella brand as such.
Yeah.
So by having two different names, okay, they're pretty close. We can see that they're, you know, they're related. The names, you know, echo off each other. But there's also a sense that they're two different companies.
Yeah.
And I think for something like Spotify, which for a long time it's looked like, you know, it's not necessarily a music-centric name. They could do other kinds of media and the word Spotify still makes sense.
Yeah.
So if Spotify were to go into video streaming or even, you know, book subscriptions or that sort of thing, all for one subscription fee, I think that's, you know, that's the kind of thing that helps keep people in one ecosystem, because people say, well, I've got one, you know, one subscription payment going out each month for all that digital content. And they're saying, so then there's less churn.
Yeah.
Video, of course, is going to be pay per view as far as, or stream, yeah, as far as I know.
Yeah.
And, you know, people are loving the audio experience, so maybe the same will be true for video. Time will tell.
Time will tell.
There's a lot of companies doing the same thing, so we'll see what happens.
Yeah, exactly. We'll see what happens on that one. But the Spotify audio rivalry is actually heating up right now. I'm seeing more and more articles that are highlighting the pluses of one and the pluses of the other, and, you know, the deficiencies of one and the deficiencies of the other. I myself am currently a Spotify user. Just because I used to work in a field where I had to access a lot of tracks very quickly, and sort of the search is just like absolutely instantaneous on the desktop client for Spotify, which made a difference for me. But of course, I'm hearing a lot of people in the industry that are really, really keen on audio in terms of user experience, and I have to agree with them that it's a great interface and you know, a great. Also, curation of the content on that front. What's your take? Who do you vote for?
Audio looks very nice. Spotify's got a huge. Well, they both got good catalogs. I mean, actually, that's the thing. Is although one company might, I don't know the exact numbers, but one company might be able to say we've got X million. The other company says we've got Y million.
Yeah.
For most people, that. It's going to have pretty much all or most of the music that you want, certainly to mainstream taste. So the only way to differentiate is for the user experience around, you know, between that and how you literally interface with the software.
Yeah.
So audio seems to be getting a lot of attention for having a nice interface. You know, companies like Apple have proven that in the long term, that's something people go for. You know, people like... people, maybe it's more I could say, actually, people don't like having difficulty with software. I think a good interface isn't necessarily like, wow, this is nice. It'll often more be an absence of not enjoying it, if you remember back to the days of Windows XP. And I think personally, I found myself banging my head on the table with that sort of thing. So audio has had a lot of... support since early on. There was some criticism about its launch strategy in the UK early on because some people felt that it didn't do a good enough job and it could have made a bigger noise.
Yeah.
And so some people thought they were kind of slacking a bit and, you know, would suffer for that. But in a way, whether it's intentional or not, you know, they've let the word of mouth kind of grow. Of course, I'm not saying they've done no press or that they've been rubbish. I'm not one to comment on that. But one way or another, whether it's intentional or not, it's kind of proven to be a good thing because the product is speaking for itself. And
now they're coming up almost as an underdog, exactly. Which is interesting.
And people love the underdog. So
definitely. And talking about underdogs, this is an underdog that didn't end very well. But we're talking about so many new services coming on the market that are new. But unfortunately, BlackBerry's BBM music service ended up being it's been announced that it's going to be closed by RIM. The service was launched in 2011 and it costs $5 per month. The service, of course, had been panned from the very beginning in the tech press, including Business Insider articles article calling it laughable, given that users were only allowed to have 50 tracks cached or downloaded on their phone, and the following month they would have to they were only able to swap 25 tracks of those for new tracks, and they had to keep 25 of those as the old ones. There were some options to build a collection if you had a lot of friends that were on the service and they could give you their tracks, and that was sort of the only way that you could really grow this pie. So that's that was kind of like a bit of a losing game from the beginning. So you know, what I'm wondering is whether the closure is more related to really BlackBerry's need to restructure, and you know, or whether it's a case that if they had been able to launch a better, more comprehensive service, whether this would have had a slightly longer lifespan. I don't know. What do you reckon? It's just tied to BlackBerry's decline in general?
I'm sure all of that would have contributed to it, but I think it's probably just because no one was using it. We can't see numbers, but I would assume that very few people were seriously using it if there was only 50 tracks that you could use. And as you say, there's more to it than that, but even now it's a fairly convoluted thing to explain. So, you know, back when, you know, if you're launching a service in 2011, not that long ago, I mean, already they're too late to really take on people seriously, I think. Certainly, you know, certainly with something which sounds pretty lackluster. I mean, things were different then. Which is why maybe it made sense for BlackBerry to, or Rim at the time, to launch to something. But it feels more like it was a kind of token music service. It's like they're saying, yeah, we have a phone. And I don't know when the decline for BlackBerry started, but they, you know, obviously they've tanked, but they were huge. A lot of people had them, you know, people in my family and friends, you know, a lot of people who kind of, even though iPhones and, you know, Android had started, but iPhones kind of were getting, you know, they were big, yeah, huge by 2011, you know, so even a few years before, but some people were still, you know, hanging on to their business phones and whatnot. Absolutely, so there was a lot of people there that, you know, there could have been a good music service for. But yeah, it just, I just think it was just not a good enough.
It's just poor offering.
And now, you know, even less people are interested. So why keep it open?
Yeah, it's just a loss of money, a loss of resources. And the interesting side of this is that they actually recommended RDO to their users as the alternative. So they actually they had some sort of deal, I guess, to offer 30 days free to their users of the service if they signed up for RDO, which was a, you know, an interesting it's an interesting turn of events. It would be even more interesting, of course, if there was a deeper partnership in terms of BlackBerry actually switching to RDO as their suggested choice for music subscription for their own users. Although at the moment I feel like it's more like a way that they're sort of letting people go gently by telling them, look, I'm sorry, we're stopping the service, but you have this great service that you can rely on instead of us now.
But maybe that does suggest that they'll go there at some point, because if they're making some kind of commitment to, you know, publicly say, yeah, RDO is good, effectively, then, you know, it would be too early to say RDO is, you know, the one to commit to and sort of let's go for a proper contract kind of deal, or, you know, some kind of proper integrated tie-in. But it's, they're already, you know, making steps towards it if they're, you know, going on record to, you know, say that sort of thing. So that's actually a really interesting point.
Yeah, and I mean, of course, you know, their decline is huge, but still, if they were to endorse a specific streaming service over another, we're still talking about millions of users. So it's not a bad really catch if that was the case.
Absolutely.
And it's also users that probably have the $10 a month required to subscribe for mobile, because most of BlackBerry users are business consumers. So that's definitely a decent demographic to tap into. So moving on from there, I wanted to talk a little bit about a YouTube deal that was made last week. We talked about it on the service on the show last week, so I don't want to dwell on it too much. But there was a very good article by Helene Lindvall on Digital Music News, talking about the YouTube SACEM Universal Music Publishing deal that we discussed. And so she points out how there are certain interesting aspects to this deal that could actually provide YouTube with a little bit more leverage when it comes to the discussions with the collection societies. In particular, she talks about the fact that the catalog from Universal Music Publishing that has been licensed is an Anglo-American one, meaning from a British or American Collection Society. And this actually means that the tracks that have contributions from societies that don't have a deal with YouTube, like STIM in Sweden, for example, that Helene is a member of, are not considered as part of the deal. So point A, a lot of tracks are, of course, discarded because not all the rights are cleared. And also the interesting thing is that the territoriality of the deal is that works for 127 territories, which allows YouTube to monetize the tracks that are part of the deal in a number of different countries. But some of those territories don't yet have a deal on a national level with the collection society of that particular country with YouTube. So that means they could be in a situation where some of the content that they have the rights for gets advertising and gets monetized, whilst the content from the local artists, because the collection society doesn't have a deal with YouTube, is not monetized. And so her point is that there could be a way in which YouTube can leverage that because, you know, artists of course are going to question their collection society and go, why are you not making a deal with YouTube, so that we can monetize in the same way as artists in the Anglo-American markets are. So a very interesting sort of little behind the scenes look here. And of course, you know, YouTube is looking for as much leverage as it can get to pressure collection societies to make a deal with them. Do you think that's a good move on their part?
I hesitate to say YouTube because really it's, you know, we shouldn't forget this is Google, and it's Google doing the old shoot first, ask questions later, or, you know, shoot first and let other people pick up the pieces later. I'm not an anti-Google sort of person, but because, I'm aware of the immense amount of good that it brings to the world. But this whole thing reminds me of an absolutely incredible documentary on Storyville recently.
Yeah,
I don't know if you saw it, it was called Google and the World Brain, and it was about Google and its practices with scanning books for Google Books, but which on the surface is a very noble endeavor, and it is in so many ways. But it was a sort of shoot first and let other people deal with the consequences later sort of thing, where a lot of copyright owners kind of got shafted.
Yeah.
It's a similar sort of thing now. Google has the winning card because it has YouTube. YouTube is, you know, it's a winning card because YouTube is excellent.
Yeah.
But the people who it really affects, which is the musicians in countries or the people who aren't necessarily being represented, or they're just being at the back of the queue.
Yeah.
Again, now, it's a hard thing to complain about because that's just the way these things have to work. Google can't go and knock on the door of every independent musician and you know, say what deal do you want. But it's just a sorry thing to see that the internet works like this.
Yeah.
And
sure.
Because of the scale of it, I can give one example of one thing I see regularly on a weekly basis of how these international dealing with content on an international level.
Yeah.
On that topic, the internet is really an international, you know, it's almost like one country. Anyone can access it, generally speaking.
Yeah.
And the problem is it has to operate on all these different kinds of rules, different countries. And that doesn't add up in so many ways. So
yeah.
I write for one site called Ultimate Guitar, and it's a rock music site. We'll often share music videos and do top tens, and we'll often use YouTube to stream the music. And the problem is a lot of countries can't access that, so people in Germany can't hear YouTube stuff. So wherever possible, we'll use SoundCloud because it does, at least can be used, heard in any country. But of course, SoundCloud, if it does, there's some rumors that it'll start paying royalties. I don't know what will happen there.
Yeah.
I think of some good reasons for it, but then one reason against it is that then it introduces a load of royalty headaches in certain countries, and then suddenly we've got the same problem with SoundCloud as we did with YouTube, and there's no international sort of platform to promote music.
Music,
so
which is a shame.
Yeah, so again, this, you know, this problem, this, you know, recent YouTube Universal news is just, it's something that's going to keep being a problem in all kinds of aspects of the internet. And, you know, it's kind of a little helpless. I don't know that in our lifetime we'll really see a solution, because, you know, there'd have to be some kind of international internet law, and it's just not going to happen.
Yeah, I mean, and it's, you know, of course I appreciate societies making a stand against YouTube when and where it's possible. And it's always like you know we often talk on the show about the breaking point where you know where is the breaking point where it's more it's better for you to make a deal with YouTube and get that money to your to your writers, and or the other point where it's better to hold out and try to negotiate a better deal than other societies have managed to get so far. So it was going to be a bit of a back and forth on that one, I'm afraid, and I know some societies have taken a really hard stance on this, but I also don't really see Google backing down too much on it. So it's going to be very interesting to see this year what's going to happen on that front. And you know, of course, streaming and digital really reflecting in the numbers for the music industry this year. The last few weeks we've been talking a lot about numbers, so there's been all sorts of reports coming out from all different countries, and every week we sort of have some sort of numbers coming in to the show to show us where the industry is going. And this year, this week, we got another three or four sets of numbers. First one comes from the IFPI, which released their big record industry numbers 2013 report, which provided extensive analysis of the performance of the industry in 2012, really. And it reiterates the very slight 0.2-0.3% growth in sales to 16.5 billion, a number that had recently been put into question a little bit in the last couple of weeks, just in light of the declines that had been reported in major markets such as the US, UK, and Germany. The justification for it is that there's actually been a real great growth in some emerging markets. So Brazil, India, and Mexico have seen a growth of 24, 42, and 17% respectively since 2008. So you know, in 4 years, really made some strides in emerging markets. And so it's not all bad news like it seemed to be, or you know, sort of static news, because 22 territories saw growth in 2012 out of the 49 markets analyzed in depth in the report. So you know, some good things, some not so good things, but of course the big thing here is that subscription revenues have risen to 500 million. So the revenues from those services,
they've gone up by 500 million. So I think it's actually gone up to 1.2 billion overall.
Yeah, you're right. Sorry.
So it's seemingly almost doubled, which is, you know, kind of mind blowing.
Which is, and it's 20% of the total recorded industry's revenues in 2012, which is wow. It's a lot. It's a lot. And in Europe, now 31% of all digital music revenues come from subscription and ad-supported services. So that's going to be an interesting play, because like it just makes, you know, Spotify and the likes, and you know, and Pandora as well, you know, all the more powerful for this. It's going to be a very interesting couple of years to see how these numbers really skew in a different direction as well. An additional study published by the NPD Group last week shows another interesting facet of this, and that was taken up also by Clyde Smith at Hypebot in a good analysis of the different reports on usage of radio for users and internet radio, of course. So the study shows that there's been a huge rise in use of services like Pandora in the 13 to 35 demographic for Q2 2012 in the US. So in that demographic, services like Pandora claim 23% of listening time, which is a 17% increase over 2011. And it was at the expense of AM/FM radio, of course, because that lost 2% year on year. And of course, both OCD, CD and digital file usage were in slight decline, and CDs more than digital file usage, of course. The interesting thing here is that we see that if you put together the on-demand streaming services and the internet radio services in terms of split, internet radio streaming services see 50% of usage in the 13 to 35 age group, split between Pandora and iHeartRadio. And this is, of course, US statistics. And on-demand streaming trails behind, with Spotify at only 9%, followed followed by surprisingly GrooveShark in the survey at 3%. So these are very interesting numbers just because they show how important Pandora Free is as a service, because it's a completely free service, and you know, it's got some sort of cap now, I think in the US for mobile streaming, but I don't think it has a cap on desktop yet in the US. And so it's a service that people can just switch on and live on for the whole day, essentially, with some advertising involved. And I think that's super interesting, because we talk so much on the show about Spotify, audio, and Deezer, and I think internet radio and internet radio streaming, which is not on demand, is such a it could be such a huge part of our listening habits, even more so in Europe, where we don't have a company like Pandora, and so the market is really up for the taking. You know, if we think there is a way that a company could interject and actually create a viable business out of that. So I don't know. Do you reckon there is a space? Of course, you know, there's a whole host of issues in the UK due to rates, and that's why really nobody has entered the and Pandora has actually pulled out of the UK for that reason, because the rates are too high for them. But do you think there could be a third market of internet radio really becoming a thing for us here, whilst it hasn't been so far?
Absolutely. I want something like Pandora. We don't have it, and it's easy to forget that this is, you know, completely normal in America. This is, you know, just as normal for streaming as it is to have on demand. It's easy to overlook that because we don't have it. It's difficult to understand what these new numbers mean for Pandora, because we haven't seen them. You know, they haven't been part of our culture necessarily. You know, something that we would talk about with friends for those very reasons. But one stat was 200 million songs just in the morning they stream before 10 o'clock every morning. Again, USA's big country, so less surprising. But I mean, that's, you know, it hits home that that's a proper radio network. That's not just, you know, some successful streaming platform. This is a proper, you know, this is. I'm sure there's lots of people who just don't use radio because they're getting everything they want from Pandora. Now, I do remember when Pandora was in the UK. This was a long time ago. I don't know when they left. I remember trying it out, and it was excellent. It was the one I used. And I think it's the angle they have is that it has this music genome project.
Yeah.
And it seems to really work. You'd put in a song that you like or an artist, and it would genuinely seem to recommend some, you know, really decent and pertinent tracks, and you would get good tips from it. The only other radio service I've experienced that with is Last FM. I think their radio had been totally underrated, but I think they've suffered from poor user experience, and I think Last FM was ahead of its time in many ways, because you know, it was amazing, but you know, the founders left, maybe that affected the vision, and it kind of, by not having sort of a clear leader in the way that other newer services, so like Spotify and Daniel Ek, or Daisy and Ian, I forget his surname now, but the guy who's come from Top Spin.
Ian Rogers, yeah.
Yeah, so, you know, by having clear leaders, then I don't know, there's something about the kind of branding and, you know,
that's missing.
Fake people can have in a company. So Last FM hasn't had that. So
yeah.
I think the interesting one could be Apple. Maybe they wouldn't come to the UK because for the same reasons for the licensing fees. But the rumors at the minute are that it would be some kind of radio service. And, you know, based on, well, their experience with technology, but also the size of the iTunes catalog, and you know, the amount of content that it can immediately stream to, but then presumably let you buy in an instant. Yeah. I think that would be compelling for a lot of people. And at the end of the day, it comes down to how good that radio stream is, because you know, Spotify, I've never been into the radio on there. I'm not sure what's going on. Maybe it's better now, but you know, it was bad enough to put me off bothering. So I think yes, in answer to your question, there is room for a radio service
in the UK. Yeah, in the UK and the rest of Europe. And of course, you touched upon some of the figures that Pandora released this week. They got to the 200 million registered users milestone. They announced that yesterday via blog post by co-founder Tim Westergreen, which was complemented with a very eye-catching info. infographic on the company's achievements. And actually, this week was a week of the infographics, because we had a very lovely infographic from the BPI, which if you go on bpi.co.uk, you should be able to find still, detailing you know, the evolution of single sales in the UK and announcing the reaching the 1 billionth download sold in the UK singles-wise. But going back to Pandora, this a very nice infographic revealing some of the more positive figures around the company, of course, and some of them include, you know, a lot of them were actually focused on discovery, like we were talking about before, and showing how much Pandora can be a driver towards discovery. So some of them, for example, were the fact that over 100,000 unique artists were played with over 1 million individual tracks during the month of March, and that was across 400 plus curated genre stations. So that's an amazing number, considering how few tracks, how many fewer tracks are played on traditional radio, of course, and it really shows how that channel can be a real valuable discovery play. Pandora, of course, has got, you know, a lot of issues to contend with, and you know, more than the 200 million registered users, there's issues on profitability, on rates, on all sorts of stuff that they have to sort of deal with. And also international expansion, as we were talking before, is a big point, because they haven't launched in some major territories that are important music wise and it'll be actually interesting to see what they're going to do in Australia and New Zealand, where they launched fairly recently, so there's no numbers really or breakdowns on that front. And so I mean, that's pretty much it on Pandora. There wasn't really much to talk about. But going back to the 1 billionth singles download in the UK, what do you think about that figure? Do you think it's representative of how much the market has grown? Because here it's really become like a huge thing. You know, the digital single chart has become perhaps one of the most important indicators of sales in the UK.
Well, I was actually kind of surprised that it hadn't happened sooner.
Yeah.
It seems like a relatively low number. I mean, I wonder if I don't understand this. Am I right to think it's the 1 billionth digital single has been sold in the UK?
That's right.
That seems really strange to me, because I'm sure, you know, iTunes has sold billions and billions. I don't know what it's at. I think it must have gone past 20 billion by now, certainly 10. But then I guess if you stack that up, you know, compared to America and other countries, then 1 billion is pretty low. So
yeah.
Well, so yeah,
that's
kind of surprised, but you know, maybe it makes sense. It's hard to kind of have perspective on numbers that big sometimes. So.
It's interesting to look at that. You know, for example, 2012, 187 million singles sold. You know, if you look at the UK population, that's almost like the 3 to 4 tracks singles downloaded per person, which is still like a relatively good number, really. So yeah,
I think there's noise in my house, but. Yeah, it starts to make sense when you see that, as you say, something like 187 million sold in the UK in 2012, I think you said that.
Yeah.
But it starts to make sense that we've only hit 1 billion then.
Yeah.
But it's, yeah, for me, it just seems a bit strange.
It just seems a bit low.
You know, because you kind of think the internet's a bigger place, you know, I'm sure there's a lot more people getting hold of music one way or another. Yeah. I'd be interested to see. You know, it'd be interesting to see genuine stats for all of these different, you know, sources.
Yeah.
But of course, we don't really have them. But if, you know, we've got 1 billion, great.
That's great. It's not bad. And they use it as an excuse to make a very nice infographic that we could have a look at, and it's lovely. And so the last thing I wanted to just touch upon, because it's a story that just broke in the last few hours, is the fact that German DJs are now protesting against a new measure taken by GEMA, which is the collection society. In Germany, in regards to DJs. So basically, what GEMA has proposed with these new fees that were announced on the 1st of April is that DJs are going to have to pay for the songs that they store digitally, because of course those songs are they plan on using those songs, and DJs have actually to be registered with GEMA in Germany to be able to operate. And so they basically added a license fee to the license fee that would have to be paid by a club when the tracks are played, and it's really high. So like the license is 13 cents of euros per track, or 125 euros for a collection of 1,000 tracks, and then it's 50 euros per each additional 500 tracks. So looking at the number that Billboard put up, it was an article by Wolfgang Spahr, if you had a 15,000 music file a collection on your hard drive and you were a DJ in Germany, you would have to pay GEMA something like 1,500 euros per year just to have that music on your drive. And then that would be completely separate from the payment that the club would have to make once you pay for the tracks. So of course this has generated a lot of protests, and over 500 DJs and members of the German Piracy Party have protested in Munich. So that's kind of crazy. But I don't know. Do you think that's something that any other collection society would ever dare to do? It seems like something that only GEMA could put together. It's crazy.
It seems absolutely balmy. I'll be brief because I can hear my kids making a racket out there. But it sounds absolutely crazy. How do they police it? If they can police it, it just criminalizes people. And it's obviously the DJs are going to find ways to hide it. So it just becomes a pain in the ass for them. So, you know, what it doesn't make sense on all kinds of levels. But one way where the only way I can see them justifying it is that potentially some DJs have stolen a lot of music. And in that sense, then they start to get some money back for people whose music has been stolen. Now, that would make sense. But then you're also billing people who may have bought all that music legitimately. So you know, things are different over there. Maybe it makes more sense in the wider context of, you know, music licensing there, but to me it just seems absolutely balmy. And how do you release it?
It's kind of strange. I wonder whether it's a measure that they're trying to take to counter the fact that songwriters are really pissed that they haven't made a deal with YouTube yet, so they can't make any money from there. So they're just trying to find a different revenue stream and go, come and have this money instead. Like, we'll give you something. Just chill out. But
how much money is it going to be? Because how many DJs are going to go, come on, look at my real hard drive.
Just take my money.
Really seriously.
And how many DJs make enough money to justify paying that much? You know,
exactly.
There's only a handful that are actually, you know, that professional that they can afford that.
What kind of knock-on effects is that going to have? Because you know, if you're a DJ and, you know, let's say you wanted to, as I'm sure they all do want to do, but let's say you wanted to stick by the law, and then you see the fees, you're like, can't be a DJ anymore.
No, exactly, that's it, that's gone. But it's going to be interesting to see how that shakes out. Anyway, I just wanted to mention it before we finish. That anything you want to plug your end before we wrap up with the show?
There's an album that I've been working on for a band over here called Vienna Circle. You could go and hear that. But it's progressive rock, so I know it's not to everyone's taste. But
Great. But
yeah, that's been a long time coming. And in fact, if you read Prog Magazine, which is very good magazine. But yeah, there'll be a sample on.
So
the
you produced
CD.
It?
I produced it. Yeah.
Oh, awesome! Great.
Yeah,
I didn't know you produced music. So
no, I've been writing the vast majority of the last 2 years. But
okay, great.
But this project started a long time ago, and it's just been sort of burning along. And that's
awesome.
That's coming out on April 22nd.
That's fantastic. Yeah. Well, thanks so much for your time, and great to have you on the show. And thanks so much for listening. This was kind of a interesting two-way episode of Digital Music Trends. You can find more on digitalmusictrends.com and follow me on Twitter on @DigiMusicTrends. Have a great week, and until next time. And you can also follow the latest on DMT by liking the page on facebook.com/DigitalMusicTrends.